They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
The vaccine news of the day offers hope to families with kids 5 to 11, the schools trying to keep those kids in the classroom, and let's be honest, the economy too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 20th of September. Good to have you along. So about that vaccine news, Pfizer and BioNTech say a smaller dose of their COVID-19 vaccine is safe and effective for children between the ages of 5 and 11. And that means shots could be getting into the arms of those younger kids by Halloween, if all goes well with the FDA emergency approval process. There were some pretty happy kids in my household this morning, already making plans for what they might do and how they might spend our money once they're fully vaccinated. And as Marketplace's Amanda Peacher reports, they aren't the only ones looking forward to that day.
When Tina Sherman in North Carolina heard about Pfizer's latest vaccine trial results, she was excited for her six-year-old son.
He got completely choked up and wanted to cry.
Her son is the only one of her four kids who is unvaccinated. They have big plans for after he gets the shot.
Yeah, we are going to go to the Cheesecake Factory and have lunch. And gosh, we have a slew of birthdays coming up, so we're going to get to do maybe indoor parties. What a concept.
And all that economic activity could be good for businesses that cater to the under 12 crowd, like the Backyard Indoor Playground in Golden Valley, Minnesota.
Kids come, they have an absolute blast. You go through all these tunnels and there are slides built within it. There are party rooms.
Rick Berno is with the city of Golden Valley, which runs the indoor playground that shut down at the start of the pandemic.
We, of course, have had no revenue from that facility for 2021.
And in the small town of Tehachapi, California, Lauren Gazakanian says her six-year-old Aria is begging to get back to ballet classes.
She absolutely loves dance, and she takes it so seriously. It's adorable.
But even once little Aria is vaccinated, there's also Gazakanian's three-year-old son. She'll still be cautious.
And, you know, it doesn't end up making you very much less anxious because you still have a child who has a chance of getting sick.
That looming chance that your kid might get sick has been at play for parents making job decisions for months. And Alicia Modestino, an economics and public affairs professor at Northeastern University, says,
moms being able to step back into the labor force, knowing for certainty that their kids will be able to attend school in person every day with minimal disruption.
She says moms have been disproportionately affected by the pandemic. So expanding vaccine eligibility to their 5 to 11-year-old kids could make the difference in getting back to work. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not a whole lot of optimism. If you haven't heard the name Evergrande yet, we'll have details when we do the numbers. More vaccinated people will help the economy, as Amanda said, but Washington has a role to play, too. The House and Senate were both back in session today for the first time since July. There's a big bunch of deadlines coming up. Government funding runs out September 30th, ahead of the new fiscal year. Around the same time, Congress also needs to raise the debt limit so the country doesn't default. Then there are the political deadlines for the infrastructure bill and that $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation package. Thank goodness Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has been following all this and is here to shed some light. Hi, Kimberly.
Hey, Amy.
So that's a lot on Congress's plate. What's at the top of the priority list?
Lawmakers are turning to the debt ceiling and government funding first. Now, usually debt limit increases pass with bipartisan support, but Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has said Democrats need to do it on their own this time. And so today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced that they're combining a debt ceiling increase into some must-pass legislation that would fund the government through the end of this year, but suspend the debt limit until the end of next year.
And what does that mean, suspend the debt limit?
It basically means to allow the government to continue borrowing money for things that it's already committed to spend money on, whether that be Social Security benefits, veterans benefits. Janet Yellen wrote in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that 97% of the debt comes from decisions made by past Congresses and presidents. So this is really just giving the government the authority to borrow the money to spend on things it's already committed to spend on.
Okay, so if this is must-pass legislation, what are Democrats offering to get Republicans on board?
So they are hoping to include some emergency disaster relief funds in light of all the wildfires and hurricanes and other natural disasters we've had, as well as funding for the Afghan evacuees, which Republicans say they would support. But Mitch McConnell said on the Senate floor today that Republicans will not support a government funding bill that includes that debt limit increase or suspension.
So about these larger initiatives, the infrastructure bill and the reconciliation package, where are we with those?
We're kind of stuck at the moment because they're kind of tangled together. Democratic moderates were promised a vote on the infrastructure bill that the Senate already passed by September the 27th. But that human infrastructure bill, that $3.5 trillion reconciliation package you were talking about earlier, that was supposed to be done around the same time. But it's on hold due to disagreements within the Democratic Party over things like taxes and drug prices and the overall price tag.
Well, we started talking about what all this uncertainty means for the economy. What can you say about that?
So if you take a step back, all of these bills and packages represent either the potential for stability when you talk about increasing the debt limit and keeping the government funded, and also a potential huge influx of government spending in the economy when we're looking at things like the infrastructure bill, and all of that can translate into growth. So getting them stalled or having them in uncertainty means those who had hoped to either get that legislation done pretty quickly have to reset their expectations, or if they're worried about the debt ceiling increase happening or not, that can make markets jittery, as we kind of saw today. And also, there's a lot of proposed tax changes being negotiated on the Hill right now, and businesses are watching and lobbying, trying to shape that final product.
All right. Kimberly Adams covers Washington for us. Thank you so much.
No problem, Amy.
It's been just over 5 weeks since the fall of Kabul, and lots of questions remain about how the Taliban will run Afghanistan and an economy that's in crisis, in part because billions of dollars in foreign aid ended overnight. We got Homa Sururi on the phone. She's an Afghan-American originally from Herat, And she now works with international organizations in Afghanistan, primarily on education and women's rights, which have already been curtailed under the Taliban, including restrictions on girls attending school and women remaining in the workforce. Homa, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Amy. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
I want to start by asking you about your family. I understand you were trying to get your father out of the country, but he wasn't able to get on a plane. How is he doing now?
Thank you for asking. My father is doing well. He's 72 years old, and we planned for him to leave Afghanistan in one of the evacuation flights. But because of the explosion that happened, all the airport gates were closed, so he couldn't leave the country. He's the only family member currently in Afghanistan. And it's been very challenging for me and my siblings, basically, to have my father alone under such circumstances.
Are you worried for his safety now?
Yes, definitely. All of his children work with international organizations, and usually that brings all kinds of threats for any family that they have been working with international organization.
I understand you and your siblings have faced challenges just trying to get money to him, and with the banks closed and long lines to withdraw small limits, limited amounts of money. What challenges has he experienced?
Yes. When we get disappointed that my father cannot leave the country, he traveled again by road to Herat. And the first challenge was sending him money, because we used to send him money on a monthly basis. So, you know, in the absence of banking system, it was very challenging. And finally, after a week or two, some banks opened, but then the amount of cash in Afghanistan was extremely limited, and there were long lines. And, you know, for an old man, it's always a big challenge to stand on those lines. Finally, just recently, Western Union opened, and we were able to send him a tiny bit of money. It's now the system is that you can only send a limited amount of money to people in Afghanistan, but still we are thankful that we are able to do so.
You have spent years working on development and gender rights in Afghanistan. When Kabul fell now about a month ago, what did that mean for your work?
So I would like to start about, you know, my feeling from the time that Kabul fell. I feel that I was driving on a motorbike down a hill with high speed. And since that day, every day gets worse. So for me, it's dreadful to watch the work we performed with the assistance from international partners are evaporated in one blink.
What are you hearing from your colleagues in Afghanistan, particularly the women that you've worked with?
They are horrified. Almost all of them, they have lost their jobs. The challenge is that there are many female households that are headed by women in Afghanistan. They lost the man of the family due to war. So this is having a terribly negative impact on many of the families that now they do not have any source of income, unfortunately.
I can't imagine how challenging this has been for you, both professionally and personally. How are you holding up?
I'm hopeful. I was not hopeful at the beginning. It took me a long time, basically, to come to this stage. And especially because I see that humanitarian organizations are pulling themselves together and they are working hard in order to continue providing aid to Afghanistan. I see dedication to education, health, and basic delivery services. So simply, we cannot just close our eyes and forget what is happening. So I'm grateful to all of those organizations that they are planning to continue their work in Afghanistan.
Homa Sorouri is an Afghan-American living in the Washington, D.C. area who works with humanitarian organizations in that country. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up.
You're stuck inside. What do you do inside?
I mean, haven't we figured that out yet? But first, let's do the numbers. Yep, it's the sad music. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 614 points, 1.75% to finish at 33,970. The NASDAQ gave up 330 points, just shy of 2.2% to end at 14,713. And the S&P 500 dropped 75 points, 1.7% to land at 4,357. The big worries dragging down stocks today start with concerns that the economic recovery is stalling, and then add worry about Chinese property developer China Evergrande Group, which is about $90 billion in debt and reportedly close to failing. That has worried investors worried about a potential chain reaction of defaults in the property sector. Evergrande's troubles mean China's likely to import less copper going forward, so mining companies took a big hit today. Freeport McMoRan lost almost 5.7%. Rio Tinto fell 2.9%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.31%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. World leaders are gathering this week in New York for the United Nations General Assembly, where climate change is front and center on the agenda. The UN recently released yet another report warning of catastrophic warming if countries don't do a lot more to cut back on greenhouse gas emissions, and soon. Now, a growing number of corporations are promising to help in that effort. More than 80 new companies announced today that they've signed on to the Climate Pledge, started by Amazon. Yes, that Amazon, and the organization Global Optimism. The goal is to get more companies to net zero emissions by 2040. Marketplace's Samantha Fields looks now at how much those pledges really matter.
A lot of corporate pledges are about optics as much as anything else. But in the case of climate change,
it's a very important signal.
Jennifer Haverkamp directs the Graham Sustainability Institute at the University of Michigan.
Companies signing on to corporate pledges is an essential piece of the overall momentum that we need to get to reductions in greenhouse gas emissions.
But the details of each company's plan to get to net zero also matter a lot, Haverkamp says.
If they have interim targets along the way and clear plans for how to meet those interim targets, that's a good sign.
But even for companies that do have detailed plans and interim targets, John Forer, director of the Institute for Corporate Responsibility at George Washington University, says it's still an open question whether these pledges will actually lead to meaningful change anytime soon.
When you look at the timeline, 2040, that's a long, long time ahead in the future. Who knows what's going to happen? So it does make it a little bit safe for a firm to make that pledge.
Procter & Gamble is one of the companies that just signed on to the climate pledge. Jack McEnany works on sustainability at P&G and says the company has already been working to reduce its emissions for a while. But that means when it comes to things it can do to reduce its emissions even further,
a lot of the low-hanging fruit is gone.
And a lot of what's left is more difficult, things the company can't just do on its own, like reducing emissions all along its huge, complex supply chain. And
how do we find sources of heat for our manufacturing operations that aren't reliant upon fossil fuels?
And that's why it's signing on to the climate pledge, McEnany says, to open up more opportunities for collaboration. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Was just talking about companies pledging to cut back on greenhouse gas emissions in an effort to fight climate change and, yes, to protect their own bottom lines. Last year, the United States had 22 climate disasters with price tags of at least $1 billion. That's the most on record, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Helping businesses prepare for climate change and the volatile weather that comes with it is becoming big business itself. So we called up Bill Kirk. He's the CEO of Weather Trends International in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. His company helps businesses figure out things like how the weather affects what we buy.
We call it the power of 1 degree. So every degree colder, there's about a 5% increase in coat sales. Every degree colder, there's about a 7% increase in mousetrap sales. Now, what are we going to buy still? Because it is so hot, you know, this September versus last year. Allergy. This is an epic allergy asthma period. This is typically the peak anyway. But last year was cold and rainy, so it kind of suppressed our allergy asthma suffering. This year, you're up probably 11 to 33%. Bug sprays. Their bugs are still real active because it's hot. So they're up 55%. So it's that change that's very important year on year.
And how do you help businesses prepare for those sometimes large and unexpected shifts? I mean, you say you're offering predictions up to a year out.
Yes, I'm a meteorologist by degree from Rutgers. We have a whole team of meteorologists, but we're more statisticians than physicists. But statistics and climate cycles are very stable. So they're a much better way to predict temperature, rainfall, snowfall. We do it by week, a year out, 32 million spots on Earth, but then correlate it back to seasonal sales. Now, if you can get that right, we can project those sales. And that's what we do for our, again, Fortune 500 clients. So it's helping companies with that inventory, right? I've heard an ad the other day talking about back to school hoodies and coats. Are you kidding me? It's 80 degrees. You know, last year it was good.
Yeah.
This year's not good.
Schools are closing early here in Baltimore because they don't have AC.
Yeah, right.
You mentioned several pretty large businesses. What about small businesses that may not have the budget for, you know, weather analytics? Are there things they can do to be more proactive?
They have to understand it, right? Here in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, with COVID, right, we all put out those outdoor seating outside restaurants that are literally in the parking lot or they're on the side of the street. So if it's 90 degrees on a hot summer day here, and that's hot for us, you're not sitting outside on the asphalt, you know, even though it's outdoor seating. You're just not doing that.
You know, for businesses that rely on a lot of foot traffic, that foot traffic can really disappear in extreme weather. And I wonder how you help those businesses think about how to keep business going when people aren't out there walking around.
A good example is that we have Arita's Italian Ice, right? So they're an outdoor venue. You've got to stand in line outside. So if it's really rainy, these Italian ice shops, their sales just plummet. Mm-hmm. But what they did once with us was give a price incentive. Buy one, get one free. Guess what? You have a whole lot of people now that'll stand in an umbrella and get a free ice for the family, right? You've convinced me to do something that I'm not inclined to do, but you got to be proactive with that plan in advance.
What are some other ways that weather affects consumer behavior? Not just what we buy, but how we shop.
Well, that's interesting. So in the summertime, if it's a beautiful weekend, you're going to go to the beach, the lake, the park. You're going to enjoy the outdoor weather. That's what we do as humans, right? But what if it's cold and rainy all weekend? You're stuck inside. What do you do inside? You're probably on your computer. You're probably on TV. You're shopping. So typically we found that really stormy weather, cold, rainy, snowy, the worse it is, overall web traffic and consumer traffic is higher. You're more likely to see an ad. You're more likely to do some shopping if the weather's really bad almost any time of year.
With climate change, you know, continuing to cause larger and larger scale disasters over the years, and people, you know, finally seeming to accept that climate change is real, do you see businesses making more investments in this kind of technology to plan ahead and to adapt?
You know, so even if it's a 1 degree hotter over 100 years, right, according to the models, it may be more extreme, maybe more volatile, like we saw, you know. You know, last year, one of the coldest Septembers in 8 years. This year, one of the hottest. You know, the changes can be huge. You know, so you have to get creative in understanding that. And I think the first step is just, let's get the next year or two right, you know, and learn to adapt to these things.
All right. Bill Kirk, CEO of Weather Trends International. Thank you so much.
Amy, happy to help.
This final note on the way out, sticking with the climate theme, could a simple coat of paint help fight global warming? That's the hope of researchers at Purdue University who've developed an ultra-white paint that reflects more than 98% of solar radiation. While most paints actually warm a surface by absorbing heat, the Purdue paint can cool a building by reflecting sunlight away from the surface, enough to potentially eliminate the need for air conditioning. And if that weren't cool enough, the scientists have also landed in Guinness World Records 2022 edition for whitest paint. The key ingredient, by the way, is barium sulfate, also found in photo paper and cosmetics. All right, we've got to go. But first, your Monday moment of economic context. It's going to be a big week for housing market news, my favorite subject, with data on new construction and home sales out in the coming days. The National Association of Home Builders got us going this morning with its monthly index of builder confidence. It was up slightly for the first time in 3 months, thanks to strong demand and lower lumber prices. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Amy Scott. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.